Welcome everybody. Bienvenue au atelier pour les postulants au programme de droit de CLLB at McGill. My name is Jillian Nickum. I'm the Acting Assistant Dean of Admissions and Recruitment in the Faculty of Law. This is going to be a bilingual presentation that will go through the reapplicant process. Just to note that le mot repostulant, c'est un mot qui est inventé. Il n'y a pas vraiment un mot qui s'applique pour décrire reapplicant en français. Alors, c'est un mot qu'on a créé. I want to just thank you for coming to this. It's courageous to come out and really take the reapplicant process by the horns. So, thank you. A little bit of an explanation about why we have this session. This session started a couple years ago, and it was mostly in response to a lot of inquiry from reapplicants wanting to know how to make their files better, wanting to know more about the process. And we found that we were having a lot of the same meetings and giving the same information over and over again, and we felt like it would be more transparent and more efficient to share the same information with everybody all at the same time. So this session is in this room because we webcast it, so it is recorded, and it is put online. So if just so you know, when we do a Q&A session at the end, we'll do, if you can write down your questions on a piece of paper, and then I'll read them out so that the audio for the questions is recorded for the webcast. And I will do the whole presentation first, and then we can do the Q&A at the end. Has anyone watched the prior webcasts from prior years? Okay. So a little bit of information changes year to year, so that's why we keep doing it and keep webcasting it. But if you want to go back and refer to this later, it will be webcast. So I introduced myself, Jillian Nickum. On va avoir aussi une étudiante ambassadeur, qui s'appelle Julie T. Elle n'est pas encore ici, alors on va lui insérer quand elle est là, quand elle est arrivée. On a aussi Anéa Curry, le commis au dossier, qui va être ici jusqu'au fin avec nous et va faciliter la période des questions. Et on a aussi Kelly Cassidy, qui est le Admissions Officer dans notre service des admissions. Bon. Le déroulement de la séance, on va parler, en premier, d'habitude on a l'étudiante ambassadeur, mais on va peut-être lui mettre à la fin, comme j'ai dit. Elle va parler pendant 5 minutes au sujet de l'expérience étudiante par rapport au repostulé. Juste pour expliquer un peu pourquoi on s'appelle un atelier, c'est parce qu'on va essayer de réfléchir, de faire un peu de travail, de vraiment regarder le processus d'un point de vue objectif et essayer de réfléchir et essayer de prendre connaissance d'une bonne manière de gérer une demande de repostulant. Alors, la première partie 1 et 2, c'est de vraiment comprendre le contexte, de relativiser le processus de demande. Et la deuxième partie, numéro 3 et 4, c'est vraiment de comprendre le passé, de faire une analyse du refus et de comprendre votre demande. Et la troisième partie, 5, 6 et 7, c'est comment se préparer pour l'avenir. Alors, et puis à la fin, on va avoir les questions. Et les sections 1 à 6 va prendre à peu près 1 heure, puis on va avoir du temps à la fin pour les questions. So, I'm going to talk a bit about the reality of the admissions process at McGill Law, just to get a sense of who's in the room. I'm curious, who here was refused as a CEGEP applicant? Okay. As a university applicant, mature applicant? Okay. Advanced standing or transfer? Okay. Was anyone refused after being on the wait list? Okay. That could apply to all categories. Reapplicant can really mean a lot of things. It can be someone who is applying, who had applied initially as a CEGEP applicant and now is applying 3 years later after doing a university degree. It can be someone who applied in the university category and was refused and maybe took a year to take a professional opportunity or do a one-year master's and is reapplying. Or it could be someone who came very close and was on the wait list till the very end and is reapplying without having had much time pass between getting their refusal, the final refusal, and the reapplication process. So different parts of the presentation will be relevant for different, they will have different relevance depending on that category and the timing, but I will go through all of them, even if they may not apply to everyone in the room because of our webcast, wanting it all to be, all the information to be there. But it's good to keep in mind that there are different implications for different categories of reapplicants, for sure. So, this may have been you at some point. A feeling of disappointment with the refusal or confusion. Really wanting to have more, you're all here, so you obviously want to have more information. You want to be able to review the process and are thinking of reapplying. So even though the process can be frustrating and confusing and disappointing, we really appreciate when candidates are polite with our office and take a positive relationship to the process. It makes us helping you be a lot easier. So we'll just put a bit of context around the application process a bit, and I'll be giving you some information that will help contextualize the competitiveness of the process. In any given year, we have over 1,000 refused candidates, and the application to class size ratio is about 8-1. So we get 8 applications for every 1 candidate who is admitted. To give you an idea, we can fit the first year class in this room, almost. If you were to fill it with refused candidates, it would be filled 5 or 6 times at least. So it is a very competitive process, and the CEGEP pool is even more selective. From experience, having reading all the files, I can say that very few files are not competitive at all. Most files are from very smart, hardworking students who have done everything right, but it's because of the competitiveness of the pool makes it so that the seats fill up before that file being competitive takes place. I'll give you a little bit more info about that stuff. Alors, l'année dernière, on avait 9,4% des candidats étaient les repostulants. Alors ça, c'est pour 2015. C'est pour la session qui vient de commencer. 12% des offres étaient à des repostulants et 14,5% de la classe entrant en était les repostulants. Alors, ça vous donne une idée qu'il y a les gens qui font les demandes de nouveau, qui sont entrés dans la classe. Ces statistiques sont meilleures que les mêmes à cette date l'an dernier. Pour vous donner une idée, il y avait 13% de la classe entrante en été les repostulants l'année dernière, puis avant ça, c'était 12%. Alors, peut-être, on espère que cette session avait aidé avec ça un peu pour aider les repostulants de améliorer leurs demandes. So we're going to go through, this is sort of understanding what your refusal letter was saying. It's a part of the second part of this presentation. Understanding the past, doing an analysis of why you were refused, doing analysis of your file. This is maybe the slightly painful part of the process and really where we're going to do the work in the workshop because we're going to work through it together. You might need to be attentive and critical of your own path to really benefit from the information. And it is meant to be helpful by giving you fact-based, transparent information. If you're here, we trust that you're listening with a positive attitude and are open to this information. And, of course, we're here to answer your questions as well. So, just to give some more context to the imbalance between the number of spots in the class and the number of applicants, the process is a comparative one where we're really comparing all of the applicant files in the pool. So because of the competitiveness, we have it's a long comparative exercise, and it might lead to refusing, like I said, files with positive elements in them. Ultimately, you were refused because there are more stronger files ahead of you for the number of spots that we have. And if you can't understand why you were refused, this is the primary reason why. The evaluation of files is done by a committee review. So on the committee, there are faculty members and student members, as well as the assistant dean. And the faculty committee review, the review committee, really looks at files from a holistic point of view. So they're taking in every element of the file as a whole. And someone could be considered for admission even though they had been refused on, the holistic process allows a file to be considered for admission even though they may be refused on one ground alone. So if grades are slightly lower but then other elements of the file bring it up, the file could be admitted. This doesn't mean that we favor candidates with lower academic records at all. The program is still it's very competitive grade-wise, and it seems fairly obvious, but it is worth noting that even though other elements of the file can pull it up, if there's not evidence in the file that the candidate can succeed academically, nothing in the file will really bring it up. So we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go along. So the elements that we use to make a holistic evaluation are the academic records, so transcripts, and the LSAT, if you wrote it, CV, personal statement, reference letters, and if any extenuating circumstances that they may have attached with your application and supporting documents for your extenuating circumstances, if there were any. Another thing that we're always looking for is evidence of linguistic abilities, so the program being bilingual in French and English, we are looking for evidence in the file that there is an ability to succeed in the bilingual element of the program. We look at all those elements together and ensure there is potential for academic success and language skills, and we also assess the potential for contribution to life at the faculty. So there's no weight given. There's no, you know, we don't give 50% of the consideration to grades, and the rest of the file is the other 50%. It's really, there's no cutoffs, like a minimum admissions GPA. In practice, with the holistic approach, the committee can, in a file, if there are two elements of a file that are weaker, less competitive, I don't like to say weaker because it is really less competitive. Even the elements that are quote-unquote weak are still quite strong, but just less competitive in the pool. So if there are two elements that are less competitive, that can usually lead to a success in the file. Any more than two weaker elements, and the file is unlikely to be admitted. So we do a first screening or a triage based on language. So if the file clearly doesn't have any English or French, and to be honest, it is really more about French capability than English, it will be refused, and that is regardless of whether or not the file is strong or weak. If we don't see any evidence of French or English, the file will go no further. And so that's how it's possible that applicants with 175 LSAT will not be admitted to the program. If there's no French, the file goes no further. So when the files are circulated to committee, they're seen by one or two or more committee members. And when they're doing a holistic evaluation and a comparative evaluation of the file, they read the entire file. We don't separate the files out. The committee member gets the file with each element in it. And they are doing a comparative exercise, which happens at two levels. So the committee reviewer, who is not the final decision maker, will read the files comparatively with the rest of the files that they have seen in the cycle. And the committee members read approximately 200 files in a cycle. Then the final reader, which is the assistant dean, will read the file with a comparative view to the entire applicant pool. So that's the two levels of comparative review that are taking place. One is the committee's set of files that they've read, and the other one is with the entire pool. So, when refused, it means very rarely that you are not competitive across the board, or more often it means that although you had a number of strong elements, there were more candidates who were overall stronger for the number of spots that are available. Okay, we're going to go through a little bit about the reasons that are given on your refusal letter and try and unpack those a little bit. So, your letter contained one of these reasons, and I'll go through them one at a time. Committee makes an effort to give an accurate and specific kind of reason in the letter. So one thing your letter could have said was there were positive elements in the file, but overall not competitive. And this is one that is most commonly used. It's for files where there's a mix of weaknesses and possibly strengths, but there was not one element that was particularly bad. There might have been several non-competitive elements. You may have come close on several elements, but overall it didn't come together as competitive in the pool. So this could even apply to a strong academic file, but the rest of the file is not competitive. The next one is that your academic portion is not competitive. And this is used for cases that are sort of out of the ballpark in terms of non-competitiveness. The reason is you'll have those transcripts forever. You can't change your transcripts in the past. So unless you have an excellent LSAT or a new degree, a new bachelor's degree or a new master's degree, some evidence of further academic achievement. Or there are extenuating circumstances that led to your academic performance being non-competitive the first time around that you did not disclose, your file is unlikely to be admitted a second time around. So if you had an academic portion not competitive letter, you need to think about how you're going to address that weakness specifically. So insufficient French proficiency, this can apply when the rest of the file was great or even if it wasn't great. If the French were improved, it is possible there'd be a chance of considering admission, but it's not necessary. The French being improved would be necessary is what I mean, but that's not to say that your file is strong overall. It's that the file went no further on the basis of lack of language proficiency. So it could have been competitive on other grounds, but it could have been. Your undergraduate degree would not be finished. So the minimum eligibility to apply in the university category is 60 university credits. But given the pool and the competitiveness of that category, our preference is really for a completed degree. It's just not competitive otherwise. Your file might have been promising. Usually these files, in the letter, we encourage the applicant to reapply. There needs to be very compelling reasons to admit someone with 60 credits. Even if there's a strong average and everything else in the file is excellent, we are almost always going to say finish your undergraduate degree and reapply, unless there are exceptional circumstances that would require you to start studying right away. If you got refused post-interview, this is something that's actually rarely used. It's more a statement of fact. An interview may have been determinative in you not getting an offer. It's actually not usually used for CEGEP applicants who are all interviewed before being admitted. CEGEP applicants are all encouraged to reapply after their undergraduate degree because a lot changes in the span of studying for an undergraduate degree. But typically in this letter, you can infer that the interview was determinative in your reason for refusal. And then if your letter encouraged you to reapply, you can infer that there are many good elements in your file. It was borderline, but not quite waitlist potential. There may be something that needs to be fixed, like your LSAT or French, or you just really need to look at your file and say, what was the weaker element here so that you can improve it moving forward. So, grasping your strengths and weaknesses. When you're looking at your file, when you go back and you are reflecting and trying to take an objective view, knowing the competitiveness and the holistic review process that we've just gone over, you're going to need to be self-aware, look objectively at your letter, your application, and you may already have an idea of how to improve. But I'm going to go into some of that a little bit deeper. So, just to explain a little bit why the admissions process is so demanding on the academic front, the average course load in the program is 15 to 18 credits. There are a lot of readings, and it's hard to stay on top of all the readings. And because it's so competitive, we have a lot of very bright, hardworking, determined students with an excellent academic record. So the faculty is quite... they feel it's quite important to make sure that the academic standards remain very high to ensure that the success of everyone who is admitted into the program. Our retention rate is very high. Most who start finish, and part of that we feel is related to the academic excellence of incoming students. So, although a 75% cumulative GPA on your undergraduate degree is actually not bad at all. It's something that is in our comparative process on the lower end of things. So some of the stats I'll share with you will give you a better sense of that. The academic competitiveness, like I said, is probably the hardest part of the process because it is set in stone and you can't actually change your transcript or your LSAT unless you've got some nuance that'll explain it. It'll follow you forever, and if it's low, it will continue to hold you back from a future candidacy. So, as discussed, we have a holistic approach with no formula, but we do have a range that is pretty consistent year to year of the statistics on who is admitted into the program. So the entering averages of the class from an academic point of view is, so 85% for university candidates, that's the average cumulative undergraduate GPA. And a 161 LSAT for those who took the LSAT. And an R-score average of 33.76 and 91% for SAGEP candidates. Just to add to that, the range of admits for this incoming year was between 74% cumulative undergraduate GPA and 94%. So that the average is 85, but the range is 74 to 94. The range of R-score is 31.8 to 37.33. And the LSAT we admitted this year is as low as 151. But it's worth noting that the 25th percentile of admits is already 83% and 32.5 R score and 158 LSAT. So that would mean that only 24% of the class has less than 82% cumulative GPA, a 33 R score, and a 158 LSAT. So that gives you a sense of the amount of exceptions that we make in the context of academic competitiveness in a given cycle. They are there, but they're less than a quarter of the class. Usually less than 10 admits are below 78% cumulative grade point average, which is still a high B+. In your university undergraduate. So again, these are not bad grades, but they pan out as less than competitive in our applicant pool. Just a note for SAGEP candidates who are reapplicants after university studies. I wouldn't really worry too much about your SAGEP grades. We don't put much weight on your SAGEP grades after you've done a university degree. They are looked at. They're part of your file. But the committee will put a higher weight on your undergraduate grades at that point. And we have admitted SAGEP students or university candidates who were SAGEP students with 26, 27 R scores, so who did much better in university. So if you have this range of grades, or this type of grades, you're in the range of admits. And so it might be useful to know what we look at when we have a file that is in this range that might make it less competitive. The committee looks at the level and progression. So if there are a lot of 200 level courses, not very many 400 level courses, your third and fourth, or depending on where you're studying, but second and third or third and fourth years have a lot of elective courses or what are known to be easier courses, the committee may get the sense that you're taking the easy way to get better grades and not challenging yourself in your undergraduate program, which can sort of undermine the competitiveness on the academic side. They also look at the rigor of the program. So if your program is known to be a rigorous program, that will be something that adds to the competitiveness of the file. and they'll look at class averages where they are there on the transcripts. So if you are, if you have excellent grades, you know, but everyone in the class is coming in at an A range or a B plus range, and you're in that same range, it doesn't really show distinction. And it can, it can make your transcripts less competitive than it appears at first glance. So if you still feel that you have the level and progression in a competitive program on your transcript, we'll take a look at some of the other elements of a file and try to break down, help you break down and work through your own profile a little bit more. Okay. So, profil concurrentiel au-delà du dossier scolaire, on a les autres documents. On a une CV, une lettre de présentation personnelle, les lettres de recommandation, on a l'évaluation des aptitudes linguistiques et on évalue les circonstances atténuant le cas échéant. Alors, c'est tout le reste du dossier. C'est aussi très important. Si vous avez d'excellentes notes et vous avez tout de même été refusé, on donne ici une analyse de quoi vous devez travailler. Dans certains cas, c'est légèrement plus facile car ce n'est pas fixé dans le passé. Peut-être c'est quelque chose à ce niveau-là, c'est peut-être plus facile des fois d'améliorer. Au niveau de CV, on cherche les expériences qui sont, bon, on compara, on cherche à voir si les expériences sont plutôt au niveau passif ou au niveau de leadership. Si vous étiez dans 8 clubs étudiants, mais pas dans un rôle de leader dans ces clubs, ça peut être quelque chose moins compétitif. On regarde la profondeur de l'implication. S'il y a une ou deux activités, mais très impliquées, c'est plus compétitif. Plusieurs combinaisons peuvent être gagnantes. Disons, le travail, le bénévole, les sports, la musique, tout autre. Il y a beaucoup d'éléments qui peuvent être en combinaison pour être un CV un peu plus fort. Mais c'est toujours, on cherche à voir la profondeur de l'engagement versus un engagement qui est moins profond. Si il y a un CV qui, il n'y a rien sauf les études et puis le travail d'été, disons, c'est quelque chose qui comparativement peut être moins compétitif. Et surtout si les notes dans ce dossier sont moyens, parce que le comité va penser peut-être que les notes peuvent être plus hautes s'il y a vraiment pas d'autres engagements en même moment pendant l'année scolaire. Au niveau de lettres de présentation personnelle, c'est important de le relire et être certaine que vous avez répondu aux 3 questions qu'on demande dans la lettre de présentation personnelle. Disons, pourquoi le droit, pourquoi ici, et qu'est-ce que vous pensez que vous allez contribuer à la faculté. C'est vraiment, ça doit être un exercice de réflexion et ça doit nous convaincre pourquoi vous aimeriez faire vos études ici. Bonjour. Alors, ça doit vraiment aller un peu plus profond. Il se peut que vous avez décrit que vous aimeriez faire vos études en droit parce que c'est quelque chose que c'était un souhait que tu as eu pendant toute ton enfance. Mais pourquoi? Si tu ne réponds pas pourquoi, ça ne répond pas beaucoup pour le comité. L'essai permet aussi aux membres du comité d'admission d'évaluer votre qualité d'écriture ainsi que votre capacité à vous exprimer clairement à l'écrit, soit en anglais ou en français. et on cherche à évaluer votre niveau de maturité et de jugement. Alors, c'est vraiment important de soyez vous-même, de nous donner une idée de qui vous êtes, d'être réel, mais aussi d'être réflexif, de vraiment réfléchir et être de nous convaincre. Les lettres de recommandation, ils sont pratiquement toujours prépositifs. Alors, c'est vraiment, ils sont vraiment utiles, mais ils posent un grave problème si les lettres de recommandation sont négatives. Alors, presque toutes les lettres sont positives, mais quand il y a quelque chose de négatif, c'est vraiment ça, il y a comme un signe au comité que ce n'est pas un candidat qui doit être admis. Mais même quand les lettres de recommandation sont positives, ils peuvent être plus ou moins utiles. C'est-à-dire que s'ils sont non spécifiques, ça nous donne l'impression qu'ils sont coupés-collés. C'est la même lettre que le prof a écrit pour plusieurs étudiants dans ce cycle. Ou si elle parle uniquement des qualités personnelles. Disons, l'étudiant est respectueuse, pose des questions, implique à l'extérieur de l'école, à l'extérieur des cours. Ils sont les commentaires positifs, mais ils sont hors sujet. Parce que ce qu'on veut savoir, ce qu'on veut voir, c'est votre capacité académique, les commentaires sur la qualité de recherche, de rédaction, de l'intelligence, que le candidat a du curiosité académique. Et si la lettre de référence ne mentionne pas ces choses, ça peut être positif, mais c'est moins compétitif parce que ça ne nous donne pas ce qu'on cherche dans les lettres. Oh, OK. Les aptitudes linguistiques, c'est pas concurrentiel dans le même sens que le reste du dossier. On vraiment cherche que les aptitudes sont là, mais quelqu'un qui est bilingue, c'est pas nécessairement plus compétitif que quelqu'un qui n'est pas complètement bilingue. Si les aptitudes sont là au niveau qu'on cherche pour le programme, le bilinguisme est là. Alors, c'est vraiment une question de si les aptitudes sont là ou non. Au niveau des circonstances atténuantes, la plupart du temps, ces circonstances expliquent quelque chose dans le dossier scolaire, des fois dans le CV. Ils peuvent avoir moindre d'impact s'ils ne sont pas supportés par les documents de support, par les preuves externes, le cas échéant, mais ils sont toujours pris en considération et je trouve que vraiment le comité donne beaucoup de bénéfices de doute aux candidats. S'il y avait quelque chose qui s'est passé, mais vous n'avez pas parlé dans votre demande la première fois, ça, peut-être vous devez penser si vous aimeriez donner une explication des circonstances atténuantes en repostulant au programme. C'est vrai. La raison, c'est que ça répond aux questions. Le comité peut avoir les questions. Pourquoi il n'y a pas beaucoup d'implications dans le CV? Pourquoi les notes sont un peu plus basses dans le deuxième semestre de deuxième année à l'université? Alors, si on répond aux questions, ça ne donne pas au comité l'espace de leur faire rendre leur propre conclusion à ces questions-là. Okay, so I'm going to move now to the next part, moving past reasons for the refusal itself and turning more to common pitfalls that we can find in the reapplication itself. So the two most common pitfalls are reapplying without hardly changing anything in your file and making improvements, but improving on things that are already strengths in your file instead of improving on weaknesses. So in the case where a reapplicant reapplies without really changing anything, it's very likely to be refused again, unless you are on the wait list until the very end, and even then, that's sort of just waiting for your luck to turn, and the applicant pool is very unlikely to be less strong in the next application cycle. So if you don't do anything to improve, the pool is likely to become less competitive. So you really need to actually work on your own file. If you improve on your strengths instead of your weaknesses, it is likely to be refused again, because the weaknesses really do need to be addressed. This is slightly more subtle, and it's important to make sure you think about it and how ways to get past it, because the committee doesn't really get past major weaknesses in a file, even when someone is reapplying. If the same weakness is there, the committee is going to have the same issues with them in the next cycle. Our natural tendency, as part of human nature, is to continue to do what we're good at. But working on the weakness is necessary, even if it's painful to do so. So, and again, working on a strength makes what was a good file now a great file, but if the weakness is still there, it's still going to have the weak file, the weakness will bring it down. Les autres pièges sont les aptitudes linguistiques inchangées. Bon, il est difficile, pas facile, mais faisable de changer les aptitudes linguistiques. So, il y a des approches différentes au refus. C'est que d'être déterminé ou d'être têtu ou borné. Alors, en s'étant à ce qu'en repostulant, se mettre à postuler à d'autres facultés de droit, cela démontre le sérieux à la démarche de vouloir étudier le droit. Un autre piège, c'est dans le nouveau essai personnel, on fait parler de rien d'autre que du refus et du chemin parcouru depuis. Alors, il ne répond pas aux trois questions. Pourquoi le droit à McGill, etc. Le nouveau essai personnel doit vraiment tenir sur ses propres et doit être comme quelque chose qui est complet, qui ne nécessite pas un regard aux anciennes demandes pour être complet. Un autre piège à éviter, c'est de brûler les ponts. La faculté essaie d'éviter d'admettre les candidats qui seraient toxiques à la communauté, aux professeurs, aux étudiantes. Vous êtes tous ici, alors je crois que vous avez tous une relation positive avec ce processus, mais c'est vraiment quelque chose qui peut faire nuire aux candidatures. Et c'est-à-dire dans ce contexte que nous comprenons la nature des étudiants qui sont intéressés à faire étudier le droit, ou au moins le stéréotype, c'est qu'ils aiment argumenter et combattre et combattre ce qu'ils perçoivent comme une injustice. Cependant, un bon juriste le fait avec un comportement respectueux, avec l'intégrité et l'intelligence. Alors, si quelqu'un agit de façon contraire à tous ces principes, lors du processus, ça peut porter préjudice à une candidature. Alors, c'est quelque chose à vraiment faire penser, d'être respectueux, parce que c'est les étudiants qu'on cherche dans notre programme, c'est ce qui améliore la vie facultaire ici. Okay, so a few more points in helping you build a more competitive application, avoiding the common pitfalls that we've talked about, being open and lucid and adaptable in reading your file, assessing what could have gone wrong for you the first time, and or in previous applications, and working to adapt your file so that it becomes more competitive. Okay, so here's a question. Can I redress my lack of academic competitiveness? So there are some ways, which I sort of spoke about really briefly already, but I'll go into a little bit more detail about how you can improve the academic record that you are ostensibly stuck with if you feel like it's less than competitive. So you could write an LSAT if you haven't already, or write it a second time if you wrote it once and you aren't happy with your score. We do look at an average of the LSAT scores, but if you did write it once and you did poorly and you think you can write it again and you will do better, it will help your file the second time around. Especially, the committee will see that you are taking strides to improve your file and you were effective in doing that if you get a better score the second time. Another idea is to do further studies, so have a more academic record to sort of counteract your existing one. So if you were to do a master's degree, which is something that is really only recommendable if it's something you actually want to do. I wouldn't say to pursue a master's degree if just to make your application to law school stronger, because you probably will be unhappy if you do that. As a comparative baseline, we look at the cumulative undergraduate grades, but if you feel that performance is less competitive, the committee will look at your later graduate grades as well and see that there is a turnaround, if there is one, and that will be something that is giving weight. And, of course, for CEGEP candidates, doing university studies before reapplying. CEGEP candidates can apply as CEGEP candidates after 1 year out of CEGEP. So you can do a year of university and then reapply. But again, like the university category, where you can apply, you are eligible to apply with 60 university credits. It's really not competitive if you are. It's less than competitive if you refuse as a CEGEP candidate, and then you reapply after 1 year of undergraduate studies. That's a very competitive way to do it. It's probably not going to be successful. It's probably better to finish your studies in your undergraduate and then reapply. Another approach is if your grades were strong enough to be admitted to another law school in Canada, but you were refused from McGill and it remains your first choice, you can go to your first year in another university and then apply to our program as a transfer student. And in this process, we don't actually, there is no cutoffs or quota for transfer students, but we get relatively few applications from transfer students. So if you do well in your first year of studies in another faculty, it can be a slightly less competitive category. We will look at your first year grades in law studies. We'll place a lot of weight on those if you're applying as a transfer student. So your transcripts from your undergraduate and CEGEP, if applicable, all your transcripts are looked at, but as a transfer candidate, your law grades are really given a lot of weight. One bit of information or advice is to check our admissions instructions on our website every year. They do change. In recent years, there was a change where you could have changes in the length of CVs and the number of reference letters you could submit. This year, we have changed how you may submit your documents, and we really request that they be submitted either online through Minerva or by email and no longer mailed at all. So little things change here and there, and if you have obviously are up to date on the process, it will help your file look clean and like you're really on your game. If you submitted two reference letters and in your previous application, but neither one of them was from a professor, it's worth noting that the committee really does prefer reference letters from academics, professors, someone who has taught you in a course who can speak to your ability to succeed in an academic environment. For mature candidates, this isn't always possible. They maybe have been out of school for too long. And if that's the case, your reference letter should come from someone who's in a supervisory role, preferably someone who can speak to your leadership skills and your analytic skills, your writing skills. But if you have access to professors who know you well, that's who your letter should come from. And it's also interesting to note that your letter should come from someone who knows you well. And if you haven't been able to cultivate relationships either with supervisors or professors who know you well enough to speak to your skills, then that might be something to think about as you think about reapplying. Okay, so what goes into a new application? So we ask if it's been less than 3 years since you last applied, the file is still in archives. So that means we will have your old application. It will become part of your new application, and the committee will see both applications. They'll get a sense of the evolution of the file, so they will look at your old CV, your new CV. They'll look at anything that's... They don't necessarily read through the first application or previous applications of the fine-tooth comb, but they will look at the reasons that were given by the other committee members, and some committee members will try and get a sense, especially through the CV and the personal statement, of how you have developed since you last applied. What has changed to make this file compelling now when maybe it wasn't the first time around or in previous applications? There are lots of reapplicants. So, you know, we saw the numbers of reapplicants and their success rate. Being a reapplicant is not something to be worried about. But keeping in mind that the committee will be looking for some kind of evolution is good to know. If it was more than 3 years since you last applied, the file is no longer in our office, so we need new everything, and there may be a note in your file saying that you had applied in previous years, but the documents will not be with the file. So into a new application, new CV, new personal statement. You don't have to completely rewrite the first personal statement, but the personal statement needs to stand on its own. You might want to talk about your refusal and what you did since the last application. And you want to show that you have reflected on the process, or not specifically on the application process, but you want to show some kind of development, either analytic or life experience, through your personal statement. So This is our third year that you do submit a new CV, which has to be under 2 pages. If it's longer than 2 pages, the committee will not read past the second page. And the personal statement must stand alone. Don't presume that the committee will reread the old one. It's something we kind of went over, but just to restate that again. As far as transcripts and reference letters, it depends. If the old transcripts you submitted were final, we still have them. You don't need to submit new ones. But if they have changed or there's any new transcripts since you last applied, then you need to submit the new ones. And any new LSAT scores you have to let us know about as well. Reference letters, you can keep the old ones if you want, the ones that are in your old application. It is really up to you if you want to submit for a new one that may have more information that could be relevant to the committee. And don't presume that the committee will go back and look at the old file. The new application should stand on its own. So I'm going to have Julie T., our student ambassador, come up and speak to you about the student perspective on the re-applicant process. She's got some good insights to share. So I will let her come up and speak, and then after we will have a Q&A session.
Bonjour tout le monde, je m'appelle Julie.
Pas là.
Oups, OK. Bon, je suis en deuxième année, mais j'étudie à temps partiel. Et je vais vous expliquer un petit peu pourquoi j'ai étudié à temps partiel et comment ça a affecté mon acheminement pour venir ici. Tout début, j'aimerais m'excuser parce que quand je deviens nerveuse, my French tends to disappear, so I will attempt to make this as bilingual as possible in the spirit of McGill's Faculty of Law, but I might wind up becoming more English than French, so my apologies in advance. So I am not a typical applicant or reapplicant. In fact, I have reapplied. I applied a total of 4 times to get into the faculty. I was pretty determined to get into McGill. I'm sure you guys, if you're here, you know how great McGill's program is, how many doors it has the potential to open. And so I was very determined to study law at McGill specifically, and maybe that sort of hindered me at the beginning. Another reason why I'm a little atypical is that I had extenuating circumstances. So I developed autoimmune diseases, and for a lot of the years of my undergrad and graduate studies, I had some medical complications, and because of that, it affected my academic performance. So I always like to tell people that I actually got expelled from undergrad and grad school, but yet I still made it here to McGill. So if I can do it, you guys can too. Donc, qu'est-ce qui arrive quand on reçoit la lettre de rejet? Ben, c'est décevant. C'est mêlant, c'est frustrant. On ne comprend pas pourquoi. Quand on parle à nos amis, notre famille, ils nous disent « Ben, coudonc, t'es fantastique, t'es parfaite. On t'aurait admis, je ne comprends pas c'est quoi le problème. » And it is normal and natural for you to take it personally. I, myself, and I know a lot of reapplicants sort of felt, well, maybe there's something wrong with me. Maybe I'm just not up to par. It's obviously something having to do with me. But the good thing is, it's not. So actually, I found out later on that a lot of my favorite law professors and jurists and even one of the vice deans of admissions had all been refused, not necessarily to McGill specifically, but to law school in general. And they didn't let it get them down, and they pursued, and they went on to do wonderful things and to follow their passion. So really, don't take it personally. It is not about you. It is about the application file and not you as an individual. So why was I determined to study at McGill? Well,
In addition to the wonderful opportunities that we have here, all sorts of placements, volunteer work, outreach programs, I really loved the sense of community that we have here. I'd heard horror stories about other law schools that shall remain nameless, but where there were students who were tearing out books from libraries just so that they could sort of get like a one-up on their fellow students. Here it's very different. We share notes. We study together. When one of us is getting discouraged, we are always there as a group to collectively support each other. And I really loved that atmosphere here at McGill. So if you're able to somehow put that, get that across in your application that you are a very community-driven person, then I would recommend doing so. Donc, qu'est-ce que j'ai fait pendant les quatre années que je soumettais des demandes et que j'attendais, je me faisais refuser ou mettre sur la liste d'attente? Bien, je suis allée poursuivre d'autres études au niveau au deuxième cycle. Donc, j'ai fait des études en business administration at the John Molson School of Business. So I loved that. I was able to do, with these extra years, I got extra work experience, which was very relevant, and I was able to get further implicated in my community and do a lot more volunteer work. But as assistant dean already pointed out, don't pursue higher studies if that's not something that you're interested in. I did it not as a way to just fill time, but really because it was something that interested me and it was an opportunity to go study something a little bit different before pursuing my ultimate passion, which was law. Donc, quelles étaient les différences entre les quatre demandes d'admission à McGill? Il y en avait plusieurs. Donc, premièrement, c'était mes notes. Donc, comme j'ai mentionné, parce que j'ai eu des problèmes médicaux et que mes notes ont souffert, pouvoir étudier plus a comme démontré mon attitude scolaire. Donc, so I was able to prove that I did have that potential when I wasn't sick. Aussi, j'ai eu la chance d'avoir plus de services, de recevoir plus de services de mon université où est-ce que j'étudiais pour faire mon bac et là, après ça, ma maîtrise. So if you guys have access to I think most universities call it a CAPS, the Career Advancement or Career and Placement Services, they really helped me going over my resume, going over my personal statement because they were an objective person who didn't know me and wasn't just telling me, oh, you're fabulous, of course you'll get in. So it really helps to have a neutral person who does not know you able to take a look at your application from an objective perspective and really help you see where there may be some weaknesses or whether you have some potential to sort of tighten things up a bit. I also tried to demonstrate my interest in pursuing law and pursuing law at McGill. But one thing that finally changed in my last year is I decided to apply, in addition to McGill, at other universities. I don't know if that made the difference because there's still a lot of confusion on my part as to what happened with my four applications, but that is something that I finally did as I decided I was willing to study elsewhere before maybe transferring back to McGill or coming back to McGill to do an LLM later on. I knew I wanted that McGill experience, but I was willing to take some other ways of getting there. And I also gained more experience in work, community, volunteer work, and things like that. Now, do I regret having spent 4 years applying at McGill? Absolutely not. I love it here. I love the cohort of students here. One thing that people had mentioned to me in previous years when I was reapplying is that when you finally do get admitted, nobody knows how many times you applied. I bet you that most of my colleagues won't know until if they watch this webcast that I applied 4 times. So there's no shame in it, and nobody will know unless you tell them. I wasn't here for the statistics, but I believe in my year there was something like 12% of the entering class were reapplicants. So it does show that there are significant portion of us who did not get in the first time for whatever reason, but that through perseverance, eventually we were able to. And so really, this is a great group of students, and I hope to see you all in 1L or upper years if you do transfers next year. So if you guys have any questions, either about reapplication specifically, or just studying at McGill, or doing part-time studies, then I am all ears. Thank you very much.
So Nea will collect, if you have any questions, she'll collect them. You can ask questions to me or Julie, and I will read them out and so that they're recorded for the webcast. Thank you. Okay. Okay, so the question is, I was initially rejected due to insufficient French proficiency. I've come to understand I'm able to review my application file. When I do so, will I be able to see the evaluation of the other elements of my file? I'm completing a full-time French immersion program and want to consider other weak elements to improve. Okay, so the question is, can you see your application file, the committee review comments in your application file? And the question is, we don't allow access to the committee review comments. If you make a request to see your file, you can see your file, but you will only have access to the documents that you actually submitted. So given that you probably know what those documents are and what they look like, seeing the files will likely be unhelpful to you. We don't allow the reference letters. Those are supposed to be confidential documents as well. So those would not be something that you would be able to review. So to answer your question about whether you can get a sense of the evaluation of the other elements of your file from the committee's point of view, I guess that the answer is no. And part of the point of this session is to kind of help you get some perspective on how to read your own file and do your own review of your file to maybe come up at the other end with an identification of what might be weak in your own file. So in terms of reviewing the file, that's sort of the nuts and bolts of it. And if there are any remaining questions about how to actually think about your own file when you go back and reread it, maybe we'll come up with more questions that will help you answer that. And Julie, if you want to jump in to answer any questions, feel free as I read them. J'ai été accepté à une autre université dans un programme de droit. Devrais-je appliquer tout de suite à McGill ou étudier un an à l'autre université et ensuite demander un transfert? Alors, la question c'est, est-ce que vous devez faire repostuler à notre programme ou au lieu de commencer dans l'autre université ou commencer dans l'autre université puis demander de faire un transfert. Ça dépend sur vous. Si vous désirez prendre une démarche sur vos objectifs d'étudier en droit, peut-être vous ne devez pas attendre pour faire une autre demande, attendre une autre année avant de commencer vos études en droit. Peut-être que vous devez commencer dans l'autre université. Mais si votre priorité est vraiment d'étudier ici et vous préférez faire ça au lieu de commencer le projet d'étudier en droit, peut-être la bonne réponse est de commencer dans un autre programme et de faire une demande de transfert. Alors, c'est vraiment à vous de décider si vous aimeriez attendre une année avant de commencer ou non. Okay. When you mention that the file should contain evidence of French, do you mean that our supporting documents should be in French, for example, the CV, reference letters, or personal statement, or are you simply referring to the elements of our supporting documents, such as classes? So that's a great question. You can submit your documents in both languages. It does help, although the committee can never can't necessarily be certain you actually wrote those documents. So it can help, but what they really want to see is evidence in a transcript or in certificates from programs that you have studied. Maybe you went to Alliance Française or Explore, or you took a bunch of French courses in your undergraduate. That's more the evidence that they're looking for. But like I said, it doesn't hurt to submit your supporting documents in French as well. The most important thing in those supporting documents is that they're clear and well written. So if you feel like you can't do that in your second language or third language, whatever, it would be best probably to stick to the language you're most comfortable with and make sure that it's well written and clear, and rely on your transcripts and certificates to provide the evidence that you've got the passive bilingualism requirement for the program. Okay, if I am pursuing a master's, an LLM, could this affect my application even though it will be finished before September 2016? No, as the short answer. I might need more clarification about why you're asking. If you are applying for September 2016 and you're pursuing further studies that will be finished by September 2016, that won't affect your application. If you're in the course of study and the committee wants to send you an offer of admission, you'll be given, it'll be conditional on you completing your course of study. So if you start studying and it looks like it's a one-year program and you get an offer, you still have to finish the program before you can start studying here.
That I actually did not finish my master's. I had one course left to graduate, but I got the offer of acceptance here, and so I was given the option. I believed you also have the option of withdrawing from your master's program, which is what I did, because after 4 years, I wasn't going to wait another year to finish one course. But then you can redo your master's studies after law as well, so that's just an option if you can't complete your studies by September.
That the option to withdraw would not doesn't this that's more actually it would be more case by case, especially with undergraduate studies. So it's more common with a master's, but as an option, it would be usually conditional on you completing it, and then if it didn't seem possible, then conversation would open up about how to make that work and if that was going to be possible. Are all advanced standing applicants called for an interview before being admitted? No. The only category of applicants that are interviewed before being admitted are SAGEP applicants. We do admit some, we do interview some candidates from other categories, but it's not a rule. It's only if the committee feels like they need more information about an applicant. Okay, transfer student. Can it be from Certificat de droit at UDM, which is a 30-credit program, instead of a first year back? No, you can't transfer from the Certificat en droit program. It really has to be the full baccalauréat a baccalaureate program or a full bachelor's program. If you are a SAGEP student applying after the first year of university, what is looked at academically? Are CEGEP students favored over U1 students? So if you were applying as a CEGEP candidate after 1 year of university, the committee would look at your first year grades, but they would also be mostly relying on your CEGEP grades. And are CEGEP students favored over U1? So students who are in university but have not graduated and aren't going to graduate before the September of the year that they're applying for. Are CEGEP students favored over U1 students? So students who are applying directly out of CEGEP as opposed to students who have done 1 year of university. CEGEP students applying are in a year, their first year of university, it's not necessarily going to be favored over somebody who has not done 1 year of university. They're still considered a CEGEP applicant. If you have been refused as a CEGEP applicant and then you go to do your first year of university, that's likely to be less competitive. We don't see a lot of CEGEP applicants who are doing 1 year of university and then applying. It's not something that is common, but it wouldn't be a negative implication if your file is strong based on your CEGEP grades. So yeah, that's a good clarification that when CEGEP students who then do a complete undergraduate degree, it is a whole new category. But often those are strong files. If you've been a strong enough student from CEGEP that you applied to get in from CEGEP, but you were not admitted and you're reapplying after an undergraduate degree, those tend to be fairly strong files. Can you use the same people as a reference but change the letter itself? The answer is yes, but you would probably want to let us know because we have, when you fill out your application, we ask you to indicate who your referees will be. And if you don't let us know that the letter itself will change, the letter from your old file might get moved into your new file. So it's important to let the admissions office know specifically that although it's the same referee, the letter will change. If I'm pursuing an LLM at University of Montreal, can you transfer some credits from the LLM to the bachelor's degree? I don't believe you can do that. We would only transfer credits from if you've done your first year of an undergraduate program at a Canadian university, and if you're an advanced standing candidate, so if you have an undergraduate degree from a school outside of Canada, some of the credits from that undergraduate degree can be counted towards your degree here. But again, it's typically undergraduate degrees only and not from master's degrees. Those are great questions. Okay, so to improve academic competitiveness, one of the options mentioned was to pursue graduate studies and reapplying. But since the graduate studies GPA is not given as much importance as an undergraduate GPA, is it recommended to do a second undergraduate degree? If yes, would you only be looking at the GPA of the second degree, or would the first undergraduate degree GPA still have an impact? So that's a great question. We do use the first undergraduate degree as a way of sorting and circulating the files for review and for reporting. So when we report on statistics of the applicant pool and statistics of the class, we will use the undergraduate degree. But if you feel like your undergraduate grades are uncompetitive and you want to improve, the master's degree grades will be looked at. However, it's right to point out that the committee typically sees the undergraduate experience as more applicable to the rigors of the program here than a master's degree. Doing a second undergraduate degree is a big undertaking, but it is certainly something that can improve your file if you feel like you need that to help the competitiveness. We do not only look at the GPA for the second degree. We look at the GPA for both degrees, so all your transcripts will be in your file. Usually, it will be indicated that there's been a second undergraduate degree, and the GPA for that degree will also be noted in your file. So it won't change the way the file is sorted necessarily, but the committee will see all of the grades, and a second undergraduate degree will be given the weight of an undergraduate degree in the assessment. Okay, quels sont les facteurs rendant les études dans une certaine faculté moins compétitive que dans une autre? Alors, est-ce que je me posais si c'est au niveau de les études dans le premier cycle des études, comme disons, qu'est-ce qui fait, qu'est-ce qui rend les études dans une faculté dans un programme de sciences politiques contre un programme d'ingénierie. Bon, les facteurs, des fois, c'est ce que le comité connaît de ce sujet, de ce programme, de cette institution. Alors, des fois, c'est pas les choses qui sont facilement mesurées, mais il y a les programmes qui ont des exigences qui sont un peu plus forts, un peu plus difficiles à avoir le succès. Alors, il n'y a pas comme un tableau qui nous dise ce programme est plus difficile que celui. C'est pas comme ça. C'est vraiment au niveau du compréhension que le comité a dans leurs expériences des programmes et des sujets qui sont enseignés dans les institutions de higher learning. Alors, il n'y a pas vraiment une réponse scientifique à cette question. Si vous croyez que votre programme est extrêmement compétitif, extrêmement difficile, mais que vos notes ne correspondent pas, ne disent pas l'histoire complète du programme, c'est une bonne idée de demander aux les gens qui écrivent les lettres de référence de faire référence au profil concurrentiel du programme et que vos notes sont vraiment hautes dans le programme, surtout s'il n'y a pas de moyens votre transcript, s'il n'y a pas if there's no averages on your transcript, c'est une bonne idée d'avoir les professeurs qui écrivent les lettres d'indiquer que vous avez fait une performance distinctive dans le programme. Should you mention your refusal in your letter of intent? That's a good question. You don't have to. You can if you think it's relevant to your experience, to your continued desire to study here. If you feel like it makes a compelling part of your story, I would say yes. You definitely don't want to make it be a main pillar of your personal statement the second time. You want to have more depth in your letter for sure. Do you have any comments on
Any thoughts on that?
So again, I still find the admissions process rather nebulous. So I can't give you advice. Like a true law student would say, I cannot give you advice. I can only give you information. So the information that I will give you is about my own reapplications. I did not reference the previous refusals. I figured I didn't really want to highlight that, and maybe they would sort of forget that I had been refused in the past. But I really did focus on improving my application, not necessarily by saying specifically, aha, look, I improved right here, but just sort of submitting stronger letters of reference. One thing I found very useful is instead of asking a professor, oh, can you write me a letter of reference, would be saying, if I were to ask you to write a letter of reference, what kinds of things might you say? And not all professors will actually tell you, but you can pay attention, and the ones who are more hesitant, or if they say, oh, well, I'll just write your grade and the class average and the fact that you came to class, that might be a little indication that, you know, maybe you want to go a different avenue. So I personally didn't highlight the refusals. I figured they could see it in the past, but I just sort of tried to strengthen what I could on my own without specifically saying that was a weakness, just in case somebody else didn't agree that it was a weakness.
That's a good answer. Thank you. Okay, how do you show that you are bilingual without writing a CV or letter of intent in French? Is attending a bilingual stage-up enough? Is it possible to submit a CV in French and English if there is a two-page limit? So, again, showing that you're bilingual or that you have aptitudes adequate for the program in both languages really will come from transcripts and certificates of completion of language programs. So it doesn't need to come from your letters, from your supporting documentation. Attending a bilingual CEGEP is definitely something that shows us you have done learning in both languages and it tends to be a good indication. In terms of submitting your CV in French and English, you can certainly do one page in French and one page in English. I don't see that very often. If anything is going to be bilingual, it's usually the personal statement. I don't think the committee would have any objection to a bilingual CV, but I do typically see the CV in one language, and if there's going to be any bilingualism, it's usually in a personal statement. So take that trend for whatever it's worth, but that's something I'm used to seeing is one language for the CVs. There are lots of really great questions. Thank you all very much for coming. I'd like to ask you to please fill out the surveys that you were given when you came in. They're really helpful for us in improving the session year to year. And if anything in this session wasn't clear, you have any further questions, you can feel free to be in touch with the admissions office. The staff is very helpful and can usually answer all your questions. Thank you again.